It's also going to be showing things like the Tim is also going to be showing things later because he's actually done things. And we were trying to fill the seminar slot, and Rich asked whether we would talk about what we're currently doing around large language models. So I figured I'd go provocative and say, please stop calling it AI. He didn't want to convey that in the seminar invite, but that's how I feel about it. There's an abstract somewhere. There's a large disclaimer that basically says, I know nothing about AI. So I shouldn't be talking. Somebody else should be talking. If you've got any interjections or objections, you want to burn the slides and do something new, just do it better than I do, go for it. I'll talk about why we're here, different things AI, as far as I want to go into it, and as far as I can go into it, and then the question of what do we do. How we got here is in September, we had Andy Chisholm from Birmingham here, and he showed us his bubble chamber project, which I've seen about a year ago. I kept thinking we should do something with it. We had given a film and we felt like we could maybe do something more. So there was a question, would we present this in masterclasses? And we basically used masterclass students as a sort of crowdsourcing for seeding event displays and getting tracking done on that. So I started messing around with GitHub Copilot, which I know you probably know, is a sort of coding agent support thing in Visual Studio that most of you will find easy to get to. Used the personal account free tier version of that and very quickly spent my 50 free requests on that. But I got something running that was written in JavaScript, used SVGs, able vector graphics, no? Don't know. SVG, an image format for vector graphics as a display, and also for the data input, which I thought was quite intriguing. I had no idea how it worked. I had no idea about JavaScript. I hate Java to start with. So JavaScript for me is an abomination. However, it works. So to me, there was a realization that, there's magic happening. And whilst I can read the code that comes out and understand what it does, I don't need to know how to write it to actually get something done. So that was an epiphany to me. I then asked around in SCFC, started with the AI service desk. Chris kindly responded and said, Chris of the Kelly Variety, for those of you who remember, said, we can pay £315 per person and then we can get a license, which I assume is per annum, because that's the scale at which these things are charged. Apparently, some other departments have bought hundreds of licenses of this. So we're spending around six figures or so on Copilot at this point for agentic coding. So then, A, I wasn't sure we did want to go down that road. I hadn't quite looked at it enough. I didn't know there was appetite in the department, so I didn't have any money to spend on it. There we go. I figured that's try and look at other options. And it turns out that these days, large language models, which are sort of basic part of running an agentic coding support, they are open source. Many of them you can just download and run yourself. It depends a bit on hardware. I may have used the opportunity to convince my wife to buy a new computer. And I started messing about with it at home. I then badgered Chris Broom for a very, very long time, which felt like a week, maybe two. And then he let me have one of our Geeson computers, because we do have quite a bit of hardware, and I'm pretty sure it's not overutilized at the moment. When it becomes overutilized, I would happily hand it back, but at the moment it's taken out of the queue, and we're running a Docker container on it that runs language models. I've downloaded a few. Stuart in particular gave it a very decent try and asked it questions around late 1989 events in various countries and figured that some of these models have an intrinsic bias where you might worry that they've been trained in particular ways. Some other models do report history accurately as far as we're aware. So we're currently running an NVIDIA model which was published around Christmas last year. It can do two parallel threads on the machine that it's running on. It's got a very large context window. Don't be fooled by that. I'll talk about context in a bit, but that doesn't mean that it's very good in large context settings, as do many. At home, I'm currently running Gwen 3 Coder Next, which is an Alibaba open source model. That one clearly has a political bias in it. However, it is the gold standard under the open source models in terms of coding. So it runs. Taking one step back, why not AI? I was going to say something a bit about machine learning. As far as I'm concerned, machine learning started somewhere with linear regression about 200 years ago. And to me, much of it is still very much that. It's trying to forecast a trajectory from something that you put in. Whether that trajectory is a value, an assessment of quality, an object found in an image, it doesn't really matter. It takes an input and it mathematically transforms that into an output. Number, vector, whatever. So linear algebra is somewhere in there. 1950 saw the term machine learning branded, and a lot of that was to do with how to turn from just linear regression into something that was trained based on a known answer. So we started looking at back propagation as a mechanism of training. We learned a lot more about that later. Training got better. I was going to briefly say, what does a simple neural network do? Who does not know what a neural network is? Who has never looked at details of neural networks at all? It's a safe environment here. You can speak up. First time I looked at neural networks was in 1998, and it was written in a book that could be bought in a normal bookshop. So I'm pretty sure they've been around for a while. People probably know about them. Take your input vector, multiply by as a scalar product by a weight vector. You get typically one constant input that's not defined as the actual input, which allows you to offset any bias that you have in your input and any inherent level that you need to get to then apply a threshold to the sum of to that scalar product, and then you get an output value. That's a single neuron. So to first order, scalar product does some sort of linear action on your values, and then you apply a threshold. Typically a soft threshold or hard threshold. If you can accept that, then what does that mean? That thing does single plane cut in your input vector. It can form one plane on whatever dimensional space you have and define a cut on that. Is that, do people agree or not agree? Is that an acceptable statement? Trying to make this interactive. So,
yes.
Okay. So if you accept that, then if you wanted to define, say, a cut section in space, I want to define, I have my easy two-dimensional space, and I just want to derive a band that says yes in my space, whatever my input vector is, then I need two of these neurons to define the two thresholds, and then I need a second layer that forms a judgment based on the output of the two neurons. Accepted? Cool. I see Chris nodding, so that's always good. So yes, two nodes in parallel can apply different plane thresholds. A second layer can then apply a cut based on multiple of these thresholds. So as you're adding layers of neurons, complexity gets added in. You can imagine that if you do multiple plane cuts and you try and fold them in all together, if you're trying to do a square cut, you can't do that purely based on, no, you could do that purely based on a two-layer network, where the first layer defines, say, two vertical cut planes, two horizontal cut planes, and the third layer always defines the difference between those two planes. What you'll find is that there is still a problem that the linear sum brings you into corners. So if you do actually want to cut just on the square, you need a third layer already just to define that spatial object. What I'm trying to say is, a neural network with two layers cannot do image recognition. It cannot tell you whether there's a cat in the image, which is what people tend to say a lot. Hidden layers add complexity, and adding two or three hidden layer makes everything possible. It really doesn't. You can, of course, define an infinite number of neurons in your first hidden layer that allows you to apply an infinite number of thresholds. And if you did that and then made a selection in the second layer on your infinite number of thresholds, then you could probably define, say, a per pixel accepting or not in an image. And it would totally kill the system. You could never train this, but it could then clearly get to the point where it identifies all the possible cat pictures in the world. It is a lot of effort for not much gain. So hidden layers add complexity. You need lots of hidden layers to do something that is really complex. Two, three, four hidden layers don't do very much. Okay, good. Moving on, deep learning. Deep learning,
yeah.
Go for it.
I'm just going back. So you're saying just four hidden layers cannot do much, irrespective of the number of nodes within the layer?
No, not irrespective of the numbers, okay. But it's very inefficient if you're trying to do something complex. And so there's things like my favorite example, neural network clusters routing in Atlas Pixels, which throws a 7x7 matrix of time over threshold values into the mix and assumes that it can do pattern recognition. And it really can't. And this is a two hidden layer network, so it's got a third output layer. So there's three nodes, so it can find squares of almost arbitrary shape, but it can't do anything more complex than a square. It can't do charge distribution into two sort of sigmoid shaped objects or something. It can't. And so looking at that network, I've always worried that people seem to infer too much from what a few hidden layers can do. And I'm pretty sure four hidden layers can't do much more. It's when we're talking about neural networks later, you see how many layers there are. And then it becomes interesting.
Okay, I'm just cautious about what.
Yeah.
The conclusion that, because I would say there's lots of factors. So the number of nodes in the layer, also training and inputs. So four for me sounds a lot.
Four is a lot of layers, but it really depends on your geometry of the hidden layers. So typical neural network designs either half the number of input layers half the number of input nodes into the first layer, or they double it. The doubling is clearly what I said earlier. If you want to define a threshold on a certain parameter axis in your input space, then you need two nodes to define a band within those thresholds. So doubling is a tendency that people do, which, for example, in the neural network cluster split and Atlas is not done. So number of hidden nodes in the first layer is exactly the same as the number of input nodes, and that really doesn't help with any pattern recognition. So it's trying to make people aware what can each layer do that will then later on help you figure out how many layers do you need to do something complex. And yes, four layers is a lot, but again, three layers can find a square. Or trapezoid, presumably, or something, but you get the gist.
Yeah, I guess
three layers don't do much. Adding one more layer doesn't do much more.
I guess my point is also architecture of those layers is important. Like, for example, you say if you go from input to the first layer and you double the nodes, then that's powerful.
Yes, number of nodes will always have an impact, and there's always a question. How many numbers do you feed in, and how much do you go up in the first dimension and then scale down to whatever your output dimensionality is? Often enough, it's one. So yeah, good. There's a lot more detail around machine learning, and that's a completely separate topic where Manny will do a seminar one day and teach us all about the basics of machine learning. What about deep learning? People keep talking about deep learning like it's magic. It is and it's not. It's lots of hidden layers. One and two hidden layers were a thing around the 2000s. It was something that people could understand. People clearly did more, but it didn't really work. And there was a phase transition where at some point people figured out how to properly train lots and lots of hidden layers. Because as you fold many values into one output value, you clearly need to understand very carefully what your first hidden layer weights are to make sure that your output weights are correct. So this back propagation of, I know the answer, I've got my input vector, but how many variables affect the output, that is the challenge. So when you add hidden layers, it becomes more and more challenging to get the input weights well-defined, as in the first weights. Man can interject if he thinks that's wrong. People figured out deep learning and the term sometime around 2010. Again, training algorithms have improved massively and hardware has improved massively, so we can do a lot more. Cool. Large language models. I know this is quick, and this wasn't going to be a training course or something. I don't know enough about it. Generative pre-trained transformers is the term, or GPT, and that's why it's called ChatGPT. What they do is, I don't know, a current model probably has 512 nodes per hidden layer, maybe 1,000, maybe 2,000, and they've got up to 40, 50 hidden layers stacked on top of one another. So earlier when we said first node is a threshold, second node is a bend, third node is a spatial object of some description, you can imagine what lots and lots of layers stacked on top of that will start adding into this. They are complex beasts. What they do is they take a piece of input text. Text gets split up into tokens. Tokens are typically a syllable. In Chinese, for example, they would be a character typically. In European languages, they tend to be either one or multiple letters, and it depends very much on what you're reading. When it's code, it really matters. When it's language in a typical English sentence, then syllables are the sort of scale of what a token should be. And tokens then define the language content, what is trying to be fed in. In a first iteration, after these tokens are generated, there will be an attention layer that tries to identify what's the important bit in this. Is Jens just waffling, and what is the part that I need to actually process? That will have a larger impact on how well that thing works or not, whether it figures out the right bits or context in your input. And it then takes what context you fed in, it processes it into an output token, a single token. So every transformer, what it does is it takes your old context, however pre-processed, and then processes that into one output token. That one output token then gets added into the context, unless that output token says end of context or something, or end of stream. So basically it's self-feeding, and it tries to complete a conversation. What these things are trained on is that if I start a sentence like, Chris Froome is, then it'll complete it, an IT specialist in PPD or something, because it's read that somewhere, and that is a reasonable end for the sentence or something. That's what it learns. So that's where, again, I feel like, is that AI? Not really. It forecasts the end of the sentence based on the start of the sentence. It can do that over a very large set of tokens, depending on the model, depending on how well it's trained. But all it does is it produces text in response to a given input text. Okay? Go for it.
There is one other difference in that. Those large language models are not deterministic. If you run it
yes.
second time, you'll say Chris Brew is a cyclist.
Yes, yes. So they have temperature, and they put thresholding in various places, and they do weird things in terms of ranking potential outputs. So they generate internally a list of potential output tokens, and they then select the output token based on a random seed and on a temperature. Yes. Each model will come with a recommendation on how to run it. Part of that is, a large part of that is they know how they trained it. They have tested it in a test bench. And they understand how to get the best results out. It also means that you don't always get the same result. Details. Prep in, prep out is the one thing. Some models are better than other with dealing with crap, but by and large, if you feed the wrong instructions in, the wrong result comes out to first order. Number of parameters help. The vocabulary set, so the input vector size per token, matters. If you've got a very large input character set, then your model can handle more complex tasks, basically. And then tools make a massive difference, which I think you will hear more about from Tim, basically. Tools allow the language model, basically you tell your language model, I need an answer to my question. And by the way, if you think you need more information, then please tell me by saying, I need this tool called, I need to ask Google what the time is in New York or something, because the language model clearly doesn't know what the time is. So then it queries that, and then it can reply, what the time in New York is. So by handing it tools and allowing it to call those tools, you're turning a language model in itself, which is just a thing that turns one string into another, into something that can behave as an agent. It can fulfill an action for you. Question that I have here, and that is mostly why I'm speaking today, is do we want to do more in that direction? We can clearly sell posts. We've got multiple models. I tried a few. I don't know what Manny's done so far in terms of running it. Tim's played around with it. Others may or may not have tried.
Yeah. I used the model. I used it. I didn't train any models.
So what we haven't done yet, lots of details around agentic systems, but Tim will show you in a bit. What we also haven't done is we haven't looked at training of models. Large language models, by and large, get trained on a basic language. They get taught a language so that they can speak, and then they often get fine-tuned in separate layers. So this is a layer separation, which allows them to understand specific contexts better. So for example, if you wanted something that is trained on coding, you go for a specific model. If you want something that's trained on poetry, whatever, then you pick another model rather than coding, because they tend to be better at one thing, not everything. Tim's
okay. Okay, so let's go over the wires. So my little bit is going to be based on a 1 hour tutorial session which was put on by the Hartree Center a couple of weeks ago now on basically the concepts and practical implementations using agentic AI tools.
Can we get a hands up who was in that training?
Yes. So they started showing how you could start basically from an empty Python shell, build up a little routine. But then they quickly moved on to using a pre-existing developed framework for this to just handle the plumbing and easier then to get to the sort of the interesting parts. So this demo then is built using this API. It's called LangGraph. And with this, you can build a graph, which then enacts a sequence of actions and links everything together. And you can build an agent from this. So this example here is sort of the simplest example of a graph you might want to build. So far, I haven't actually had to go beyond this particular graph structure. So you go into an LLM node here, which receives a query and then is going to produce text as an output. The output of it goes into this conditional edge, and there's two options from here. Either the conversation or the task of the agent can be finished and it goes down to the end node, or if it decides it has more work to do, it can go down this action node, and its particular query can be dispatched to a tool, which lets it then gain additional information. That information feeds back into the LLM, and this cycle here on the right will continue multiple times until the processing is finished. So to give an example, this is Hartree's example. They define three tools. There's a Wikipedia search. Search Wikipedia and return a short summary, e.g. what is agentic AI, and you can see this does return wikipedia.summary query sentences equals three using an existing Wikipedia Python API. There's a stock price tool, which has a Yahoo Finance API and just returns Yahoo Finance.ticker and returns the ticker is currently trading at price. And then finally, a calculator tool, which simply does Python string evaluate expression. To do some maths. The way that these tools, you see they have a Python annotation, so these are integrated. The large language model knows docstring, so it's for humans to understand the tool, but it's also for the LLM to understand how to use this tool. And then the final thing which is needed is a prompt. So you need to give your LLM node its job description, if you will. So the one they use here, you're an autonomous AI agent. You may use tools to help answer the user's questions. Don't mention the fact that you used a tool, et cetera. If you used it, incorporate the results naturally into your response. And these are three tools available to you.
So you can then run this. I can give it an input. Look up a few prominent FTSE stocks and tell me their current prices. If I do this, then the model starts going away, churning off on its own. So it starts asking Wikipedia for FTSE 100 constituents. It does it twice. I don't know why. Then does index. It seems to get itself a bit stuck in the loop, to be honest here. It keeps on going down, asking it various combinations in Wiki until it finally decides, OK, I'm going to ask for stock trawl for BP. Do a few more Wiki searches for all Dutch Shell ticker, Shell, HSBC. First it gets it wrong, it says HSBA. Realizes it's making a mistake, it does HSBC, it does AZN, which is AstraZeneca. And then finally, after all of these, after it's done all of this, it takes about 30 seconds in total, it prints the final result. Here are a few well-known FTSE 100 constituents and the current share prices, which were correct. So it did manage to correctly go off, perform the task I gave it, using the resources I gave it access to, and come back. So that is all using this basic graph node. As I say, I've not had an opportunity, I've not really had a reason yet to go beyond this, but you could think about, you could have multiple of these LLM nodes. You could give them different prompts so that they have different behaviors, and then they can, the model can talk to itself with sort of different hats on. You could have different nodes which go to different backend large language models, because of course some are more specialized than others. You could have one which is more specialized for coding, looking at coding problems. You could have another one which is maybe better at natural text generation, looking at emails and things like that, and have one at the top which is deciding, okay, does this go to the coding box, does this go to the email box, etc.
So to which ancient much large language model did you use? Was that the Google one they suggested in the...
Okay, so I started this using, so this was run on a Google Colab image tutorial connecting to Gemini.
Gemini, that was it.
But within like 10 minutes, I ran out of token. Gemini only gives you 20 requests per day. And each of these is a request. So you can see this one command here would instantly have run out of my Gemini.
So this wasn't your Gemini because you'd already run out?
No. So this is all running backed locally by the LLM running on Mercury, which Jen set up. I kind of wanted to continue the exercise. And my first thing was really just get this current exercise running so I can play with it a bit more, because without paying for Gemini, you very quickly can't run that anymore. So that then gets the Hartree example up and running up to the end of the tutorial. So I have had a little bit more playing around, sort of saying, okay, this is great, but I don't really need to know the stock price of AstraZeneca right now. How can it help me more with my day-to-day stuff? So I introduced, I gave it a few more tools. I gave it a very simple, I call it the coding standards tool. In Atlas, we have one web page of Markdown, which has all of the standards by which our C++ and Python code should conform. So I gave it a very simple way to search for terms and return paragraphs from our coding standards tool. I also gave it access to a couple of Unix command line tools. So I gave it access to find, and I gave it access to git. And I told it, you're an autonomous AI agent, which is an expert developer of Athena, a large C++ and Python framework used by the Atlas experiment. You may use tools to help answer the user's questions. I also found that it was doing some very wrong things in git initially, so I needed to give it a little bit of a hint, but remember that source files are all located within subfolders, packages, in Athena. You'll often need to give a full path to a file when using git and failing your tools. And so with that, I could ask it, please review code within this package, trigger analysis, trigger nav spinning MT. This happens to be one of my packages, so I thought I'd give it that as a test. It went off and it did git ls files. It queried the coding standards tool for the naming. It then did some more git show head of the main header and the main source files, and it queried the coding standards tools again, error handling. Based on that, it then produced a large Markdown output where it did a reasonable, to the extent where it is definitely useful, review of the code. I would have liked it to have looked a bit more at the different areas of the coding standards, but for a first try, basically, already very impressive start. And I link a full example output of what it's doing there. So given that very promising start, I've actually been using it for the last couple of weeks. So I'm currently doing Atlas code review shifts. Every afternoon, I sign on and look for merge requests which have been flagged for some more review, and I look through them. But I'm also now running a little bit of Python code where I put in the merge request number and the number of commits in the merge request. I then run a Git MR origin checkout, just using GitLab Python specifics to check out a specific merge request locally. And then once it's checked out, I can tell the model, please perform code review for the code we checked out Athena branch. The developers were, it's in this case, the last 8 commits on the branch. And it does a very similar thing. It does Git tools, it does coding standards. It's not going to find special geometry toroid in the coding standards, so that was a bad request. But it did get more hits for naming conventions. It then looks for a cert and it does some finds. So this is a little bit where I'm a little bit conflicted. Find is a very powerful Unix tool, but it has lots of edge cases. And in this case, the LLM is using it very powerfully. It's doing find.name, asterisk.python, and then exec grep on that for geometry toroid. That's great. That's a really powerful way of doing it. But of course, if you're doing exec, there's more things which could happen in there.
As a complete, ignoramus, I know all kinds of shifts, but I never heard of a code review shift. What are you actually?
In order to keep the quality of my code base reasonably high, when somebody wants to make a change, they open what we call a merge request, which is where they bundle their changes into a little package. They write a description of what they want to do. And then this gets presented on the web page where you see the description, you see the list of all, like the diff basically, of all of the code changes. And we can interactively comment, discuss the changes with the developer, iterate over the changes until everybody's happy that they are in a state to be merged. At that point, the release coordinator will press a merge button, which then integrates the changes into the code base, and then they become part of the next nightly.
So presumably it's a good way for people to learn. I mean, these people on shift are going to be experts, and somebody trying something maybe not an expert, and you can really help. Sounds good.
Absolutely, yes. And this has been really, I class myself as an expert of our code, but this has been a really helpful thing to, it gives me a second opinion, basically. I can look over it. I then look at what the large language model spat out from running through its thoughts. I compare them to mine. See, maybe it picks up something I missed, especially if you're reading through quite fast. It's quite easy to miss the occasional thing here and there. So I don't think it's at the stage where it's going to replace me doing code review, at least not yet. But as a second opinion, I'm finding it's saving me a lot of time, and it's letting me go through this faster than it otherwise would.
I have a question on the previous page, very quickly. So how is the connection between the query in the form of human message and the calls that are generated below that?
So
shall we look at that later?
Yeah, we can,
or maybe
we can come back to
it's Python
to look at that.
Okay.
Less than 200 lines, I think.
Mm-hmm.
You'll see there at the beginning, it's tagged human message.
Mm-hmm.
So in essence, what you're doing is you're just building up a long conversation history like a chat log, where every message is flagged, and it's going to be flagged human message, tool message, AI message. There might be another couple of categories, but those are the main ones. And you just build up a long, like a chat history, as it progresses down through all these stages. So my thoughts are that it really took very little effort to write up a simple agent graph with one node being the large language model node and a suite of custom tools available to it. General question, is it better to be routing through a local open source large language model than Copilot? I would say yes. We have more control over exactly what information gets sent. I would feel if we're starting to put sort of more sensitive data in it as well, it's nice to know that everything is local and nothing's having to go off to the cloud. I would say it's very important to audit the tool requests the large language model is making. And so far, nothing outright malicious or dangerously stupid has been observed. And the LLM when it's executing commands via Python, it's not doing it in a shell. So it can't use pipes, it can't use redirects and things like that. So that somewhat limits the sort of danger footprint. But I mean, as you saw on the previous page, if you get it to find, then it's already got a way to do more expressive commands. And there's a trade-off. If you give it more powerful tools, it can do more powerful things, but there's more potential for misuse. So it's
just, can you audit it before it runs?
You can. You can put a human in the loop node.
You can run explicit command checks, but
I did put in a check. It cannot include the string rm space anywhere in the find tool. I put that one in explicitly.
That minus delete.
I also didn't want to have to be sort of sitting here. Is this command okay? Press enter. Yes, yeah. Command.
Developing that level of trust.
I'm already using this to augment my merge review shift work. I'm working on getting controlled access to my emails. It's my next thing. Please think, what else could it do? And the code I've been using so far is available on the local AI coding there. That's it for me. I'll come back to you for summary.
What do we have? We do have a locally hosted language model. We are looking at getting hardware through SCD that would be slightly more up to date, slightly better in terms of total memory, but otherwise very similar to what we're currently running. And it would likely run similar models. Models keep evolving. And what I would say is the open source model side of things is probably maybe half a year or so behind what the commercial models are in terms of how fast and how well they process things. However, they are catching up. It was definitely more than a year behind not too long ago. And you can see how they're catching up with a lot of speed. So we're getting a machine ready to run this as an explicit host for it, rather than stealing one of the HAPACs. It's got a web interface if you want to play with it, as in talk to your local agent, whatever, then you could talk to it. We haven't done much more. I mean, Tim is actively pursuing this because there are benefits to it. A lot of people are also hesitant about it, but I'd be happy to hear feelings about it. I'm more hesitant to ask Copilot about things, but why don't we have more? Tim has spent a full day setting up, so you saw earlier, to run against local agent and to do a bit of apps coding standard and all of that, but it was just one day. However, it's taken the day out of his life, so he needed to catch that back. I've probably spent 2 days total around the whole hosting setup. A lot of that was figuring out which model, what parameters, which machine, Docker, finicky bits, whatever. I think bottom line is if we do want more, if we are keen to try more, then we'll need to put more time into it. Who, when, what, is basically up to you. But I figured this would start the discussion. There are some links. Hug and Face is the repository for open source large language models and a lot of things around what the modern world calls AI, and we should be calling large language models. Unsloth in particular is, I keep wanting to say a company, but I'm not quite sure, but they produce a lot of the open source quantized models that exist out there, and they tend to apply fixes to the models as delivered by the person originally owning it. Quite often there are problems with the communication template, as in how you feed things into the model, and Unsloth is one of those groups that will fix those and make it work. They have a lot of articles around how to train, how to fine-tune, how to use RAG, whatsoever. Lots of time being spent reading that if you want to. LangGraph, that is what Tim just showed. I put a link in there for an example of LangGraph together with Open Web UI, we can look at what the web interface for the LLM looks like, which is Open Web UI. But in principle, it doesn't need to be just the language model. You can have a whole agent behind your chat interface and talk to the agent and give it the resources that it needs to do your work for you. Yeah. Open code running in Docker. Sorry, that's not linked yet, but that is a link. I have been using open code a lot at home, a bit at work, and I've started to encapsulate it. This has been on a chat that we have in PPD Teams, the AI coding channel. The suggestion is that if you wanted to use a coding agent, or if you wanted to use your LLM together with something that is basically a coding agent in a box, then best, as Tim just said, you want to avoid it being able to access all your files. So the easiest way to do that is run it in a Docker container, only target one specific project folder, whatever it does in there. If it's your fresh git checkout in a new folder, it can wreak havoc on that. You kill the thing, you delete the folder, you start fresh. So that would be the worst that happens. And I find that the Dockerized version doesn't run any worse than anything else. So that's that. Have people seen this? Who has looked at self-hosted model? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. Okay. this is where it went wrong.
Can we take a question in the meantime? Yes, Brish, go ahead. Hello?
Hi. Yes. Okay. I mean, I can wait for the demonstration. Please finish it and then I'll come back.
You don't have to. Please.
All right. So while you're preparing, just, I mean, thank you, Jens and Tim, for preparing this at such short notice. So before I come to my question, I just wanted to mention that the idea behind this Let's Talk at AI series of seminars is to openly share and discuss ideas and ongoing work, even if it isn't fully formed yet. The goal is to encourage honest conversation and help us better understand PPD's engagement and interest in this area. So if you have any ideas for the next seminar which you'd like to share with us, then please do let us know and then we'll book you in. Now my question is, from the experience of hosting this local LLM in our local infrastructure, I just wanted to ask, did you try enabling MCP agents which can fetch information from internet directly? Or these are fully enclosed LLM models which we have hosted?
So the LLM model that is hosted runs without any connection to the outside world. It's purely internal. However, what you've seen, what Tim has shown us, uses other tools to run the queries that the LLM might want to run. So if you're setting it up in a way that we present it with tools and these tools can then access the internet, then yes, it could fetch information from the internet. We're being very careful about this. I think we're being quite slow compared to maybe other people out there. But you want to be mindful of what it might do if you give it just an HTTP interface.
Yeah, true. Then the second question I had was in terms of storage, I mean, with your usage of it, how do you see a single user for example, having coding something in Athena scale of software stack? How much storage in terms of the context we will need to have in our infrastructure and how it is going to grow,
cold storage is one thing, I guess, and Athena is, Jim was saying it earlier, a few gigabytes. Mm-hmm.
Feeding the bits of time.
Yeah. Context windows for large language models, the decent coding models have somewhere around 250,000 up to 1 million tokens. Nemotron is technically not a coding model, the thing that we're currently running, and it's got a 1 million token input window. I am quite sure that when you feed it more than 30,000 tokens, you will see the quality of the output degrading. So there's a there's an interesting question whether we need to run a different model with smaller context window, but with much better coherence up to the limit of the context window. Other models are slower, depending on which model we choose. But we haven't really had that conversation. Like people haven't come up and said, could you do this or could we host that? So it's worthwhile bringing this out here and saying, if you would fancy trying something, we could probably try something. It's just in absence of having any input, I just run whatever I feel like. You can then tell me off for it won't work.
Thank you. That
here is the chat interface. So if you just go to hepx16.pp.rl.ac.uk on port 8000, you've got a non-encrypted web interface. This bits that I need to fix about all of this, which is why it's not quite public. But it is the response mechanic that will chat to you. If you look at the same thing, same web interface, but on what is called the OpenAI interface. Then, for example, you get JSON replies for what is currently being hosted. OpenAI at some point went in and defined a standard web interface based on GET and POST methods to be able to send things to the web server and get the price back. All of it encoded in JSON. So when you're interacting with a model like Tim does, then what's happening is you're using that web interface to chat to it. It runs metrics in the background, which we can now see how much Tim has been using this. Not quite, because it doesn't really keep user stats, but we've processed 280,000 prompt tokens, which isn't a lot. Much of that might have been moving earlier today. Yep. Chris.
Hopefully I'm safely far enough away from you to ask this question. Can you just give a brief summary of SDFC policy on this? You know,
No. So what I went through when I asked the AI about this is that Chris was very nice, said he can forward me to information security and they can talk to me about hosting language models or something, which they really can't, they have no clue. What they have done is they have vetted Copilot, and in particular Copilot Chat, which means we can use Copilot when we have the appropriate licenses to process work-related documents, and that is guaranteed to keep them safe as far as InfoSec is concerned. They haven't done much else on anything. There is people in SCD who run a small source model start coder, which is a line completion model. So when you're in your editor and you're starting to type a line and it then suggests, oh, you might want to finish it like this because I know your variable names and I know what you're doing. So I'll just suggest it to you and then you press tab and it's done. They run that model over an SCD. They're not running anything bigger. I think asked them about it. There was zero response really. So they haven't come back and said, oh, if you're hosting this, we'd be keen to try. Nothing. So we've asked around in various departments, not much came back. So these guys in SCD have said that they've done a risk assessment for StartCoder, which is an AI something or other risk assessment. I have started filling one out and sent that to the primary source of all risk assessments, which is Justine Manino in STC. See, she had a look at it, turned it into an Excel spreadsheet, made it really complex using ChatGPT, added lots of solutions using ChatGPT, which I then broke down into what I'm going to do for now, because a lot of these things sound very intelligent, but also make a lot of work and don't really add much benefit. So there is a risk assessment for this currently running in STFC in PPD. As a playground. If we wanted to turn this into more, we might need to look at the risk assessment again, but by and large, nobody objected to it.
Thank
you. Well, UKRA has banned DeepSeek.
Yes. So that was the only thing that came back from InfoSec, I think. They said DeepSeek can't be done.
Which is odd because it can be run locally without sending things to
Well, and yeah, and any locally run model, as far as information security is concerned, it's none of their business. If you know that it doesn't send things out because you're hosting it yourself, an engine that you know doesn't send requests to the outside world, then whatever, your problem. However, it is frowned upon because politically it's challenging, and this is the exact same problem that we have with models like Gwen 3 Fogger. If you ask the question that I just typed into Nemotron about Germany in 1989, if you change Germany for China, the reply in Nemotron is very good and it summarizes what happened. If you ask the same thing in Gwen 3 Polder, it suggests that you might be violating law or committing a crime by insinuating something, and you're literally just asking a question. But because you mentioned China in 1989 in one sentence, it will right away stop processing your request and tell you to go and do something. Stuart has had lots of fun trying to make it speak to him in iambic pentameter and therefore forcing a reply that was actually quite accurate. However, it was so twisted that the model couldn't quite identify what was happening and just delivered the factual reply rather than trying to be stopped from it. So there are questions like, would we run DeepSeek? Don't know. There are so many open source models that derive from DeepSeek that it's very hard to say you're running a model that has never been touched by anything Chinese. So, and I don't think we should, because they're really good at trying to push the boundaries of this. So this, but that's politics. I don't know if I want to be too involved. There's a risk assessment for it. We should stick with that. Go for it.
Yeah. So because you are running some of the AI models like LLM for project management. So if we download one of the open source, do we need to do some sort of assessment? For example, we don't allow any internet connection to that AI model that is downloaded into Mercury.
So we should have a separate conversation about that. In principle, you need to do a risk assessment for any activity that you do in this organization, because that's what we strive to do. That's what we're here for.
Not
That's why we get
necessarily.
paid bucks. Yes, it definitely helps to not open ports to the outside world, which I think you will find hard to do within the organization. And if you do open ports on your computer, somebody will find out and eventually tell you off. Which this on the HEPAC, we do see scans happening that find the ports that are open and start dropping. So there's a question whether that is gonna throw somebody off or not soon enough. The other question is, what are you running? Why wouldn't you run against this model, as in centrally? Because this runs fast. Whatever hardware you have, I'm pretty sure this runs faster. And with larger context, larger parameter space, unless I'm missing something that's happening with the project itself. But we should have a conversation about that.
I had two questions. One is like, so when you're loading the Nemotron, it's pre-trained, and my point is like you're using an infrastructure which is probably not as simple to like I don't know if I was loading the model onto a GPU, I would have longer, I'd take longer than 2 days to load this model. So is this something that's already
What
I
do you
don't know
load? Just from this to
run commands on run computation on the GPU.
So computational GPU. At home, I run these models on two RTX 5060 Ti's with 16 GB each, and they easily run Nemotron in a 4-bit organization with high precision input processing. So it's 24 GB or so total size, and with 130K context, and that runs as fast as here. Here we're running on two A100s with 80 GB of HBM memory, so they should be faster. However, their previous generation, so in terms of how they process complex stuff, they're just not quite as good.
But how do they use the, like, is there internal settings that you can just specify? Like, I'm giving you this GPU, or you have this many GPU cores with
Yes.
this compute capability, and it automatically adjusts.
So with Llama CPP, which is the go-to solution for lots of people if you want to have fine grained control. You can tell it which layers to offload to which GPU. You can tell it to keep the cache in system memory or put that on GPU. You can, there's all sorts of tweaks you can do. It gets infinitely complex. I haven't done any of that. I've literally just said to it, you've got two GPUs, fire away. Here's the problem. One of the things that I start noticing is because it puts the key value cache on one of the graphics cards. One of the graphics cards has 60 gigabytes of VRAM use, and the other one's only got 40 gigabytes of VRAM use. So we could, in principle, run more queues. At the moment, we've got two parallel queues for this model. So two parallel requests can run. We could, in principle, run more if I started doing things like moving a larger fraction of the layers to the second GPU to keep more KV cache on the first GPU.
The second question that I had was related to the original goal, which is to have an interface running with VS Code, which I tried. Is that already solved?
So many not, hopefully it is. In the AI coding teams channel, there's shared files, there's a VS Code config, which I think I updated. Problem was there was a YAML version and the JSON version or something, and I don't know whether both of them are updated or not. Because at some point we changed the model from Web3 Toller to Nemotron. Yeah, it depends.
I've used it with a YAML configuration VS Code, and it works, and it's nice.
Does that do the line completion stuff?
I don't test that.
You have to ask your queries and stuff like that.
Line completion are technically, they're slightly different in how they run. And I think the configuration isn't set up to do autocomplete through this model because it's a very costly model to run. And line completion you can do with smaller models. So what we could do is, given that there's already a risk assessment for it, we could take sample of two, which is a 2 billion parameter model, and we could load that on the same GPUs and just run that as the autocomplete model. It would run in the same instance, it would serve a different purpose. So therefore, through the OpenAI interface, you ask for a specific task to be done, and embedding would be one of those, autocomplete would be another.
Yeah, just want to make a comment, Dylan, to say, this stuff that you've been doing is really, really nice, and that even I'm just starting to learn what you can do with these large language models. And I mean, it was Jacob just showed me, I was sat with him and he showed me how he refactored, you know, built a whole new code network. And they all use large language models, which typically you have to pay for, as we've seen, like Gemini, they'll entice you in with some tokens and then they run out, Copart. It's all very expensive. However, what we have here in the department is something that's free. And okay, it's not exactly the same, but I've not been able to tell the difference at level that I've been working at. But these large algorithms are plug into many, many things, which I think we're all going to start to explore. And I think it's very, very valuable.
Use things like Podcode or Copilot properly integrated, then you will find that they are better at following your instructions and delivering something functional on first attempt. Claude is insanely expensive. There's a huge question around fairness to me. Some people in the department can afford, I can afford to buy a computer for myself, right? Or I can run it at home. Other people can afford to pay for a Claude license. And we shouldn't end up in a situation where somebody in the corridor has the ability to afford a Claude code license and therefore they can do three times as much coding work as others. And then get away without having to do lab cleaning because they're so good at coding. Like we want to make sure that we understand as a department how we're engaging with this. And if the decision is to just pay for Copilot, actually, fine by me, it's just a number and spreadsheet. But we need to make the choice. And I think, at least from my end, I would say we have more appetite in understanding the mechanics of it and doing more with it rather than just using what we're given.
I mean, I would also say something more. I mean, my perspective is not just a number in a spreadsheet. In that, I mean, you're saying six figures for a deployment?
Yes.
Can we do better? And I think if we can...
So for our department, we're talking £30,000 a year.
Right. A year, and
which is a budget to refer black equipment or buy computers or whatever. So
there is the other stuff that I've not tried Copilot for, but it does have the potential to, you know, read your email for you and flag up stuff that should be done, write documents for you, given other stuff, summarize stuff. Does this have the potential to do that? I know you said something about
email. I have certainly dumped text into this. Not saying that was in any way related to presence or something. I said, my English isn't good enough to get the tone of this right. Please fix this. And it does. And then when I read it, I realize what it's done, and it does read better.
Yeah.
It's just that I couldn't naturally come up with this. So yes, it does text processing to a level where it's really being helpful. You can dump some types of input files into the web interface. One of the things that I tried doing with it is make it run TCAD for me. So I wanted a basic silicon drift detector design. And rather than starting to write the lines of TCAD myself, I just say, make me silicon drift detector design. And by the way, here's the CentAurus device manual appendix on commands. Use these. If you don't give it the command manual, it perfectly well hallucinates you a file that has nothing to do with CentAurus device. However, if you do give it the manual, the commands work and it produces a structure. Isn't perfect. What not? But by and large, if you give it within its context the right input to process your request, it does things. And so, attaching a text file with apps coding standards or something, and then saying, read me this C++ file and tell me whether it complies, will definitely work.
And we have a question on Zoom because because it's waiting for a long time. Yes, go ahead.
Yes, hi. I was going to ask about the use of containers to make this rather safer. Have you used this already? Have you tested this? I'm thinking about how you get the commands into the container and then out again. Whether you could, the things that Tim was describing were, I guess, were not done in the container because you don't want to.
You would pull a standard Ubuntu Python container or something. You would mount a subfolder that has your script in it. You would then tell the container to run the first command, or you would run it interactive, and then just run that command. The thing that I've done with open code is there's a repository that dockerizes open code, which again is a sort of agentic coding system that just needs an LLM in the back of it. It can make mistakes. It browses through your folder hierarchy and deletes other projects and stuff, has definitely all been seen. So you want to containerize that. People have done that. You literally just call it in its dockerized version on a folder where you want to run it. And the Docker container will start mount that folder as the workspace, and you can then run on that workspace.
For a lot of the stuff you can mount all the stuff read only, and only the bit you want it to modify could be a local folder.
The purpose of the agentic system is to make it do stuff. So you want to allow it to edit some files, and this is where you would mount the one folder that you need that. Is maybe a temporary copy of what you're trying to work on, and then run on that. And yes, we've got first examples of how to run that, so happy to try if you wanted to try.
I was actually struck by Tim's example, where actually you don't need any modifications there. It's asking, you need modifications internally to check out the right merge request, but after that, it's just a matter of searching the existing code. So that could all be mounted read only. But I think probably there's a lot of cases where you want it to suggest things to improve, and so it could do that in its own little sandbox, and then you actually
It can
make
do
the
that in
changes.
sandbox. It can do that in sandbox. It can even do the git commits for you with appropriate messages and then file a merge request.
Yeah, that's where
So,
I start to get nervous about
yes.
it.
But then it depends on API tokens, how you allow Git to interact with a repo, with a GitLab repo, so that you do actually get a merge request in rather than a forced push that deletes the whole repo.
Yeah.
So I think that there's multiple ways of attacking this so that you're isolated from the world in a way that it can't do harm. You only live once is a phrase being tossed around a lot with large language models.
So I'm just wondering whether we can if we're worried about kind of risk assessments and that sort of thing, whether we can make a code of practice or a kind of examples so that everybody, so people using this can set it up, and people who have thought about the dangers can set up or help set up something like this. I'm wondering if we all do this with containers, are we going to all come up with our own solution as you suggest? But then perhaps I won't spot the clever way that the AI could delete all my code, or could submit a
Well,
merge request that would cause great embarrassment.
we started the repository group on GitLab last week when Tim had code to submit into it. Since then, nobody's done any. Well, Tim's done more work on his version, but like people haven't started looking at this. So this is the first iteration. I'd be happy to say we can make a containerizer repo or something and start talking about, or we can add a Docker file to Git's repo, Tim's repo, and start talking about how you would run that using Docker. It's just we haven't gotten there yet.
Yeah. Just suggesting. Yeah, that would be a nice thing, and I'd be
Yeah.
interested to help work on that.
This is a question I think for you and Chris. I mean, also, it doesn't address everything, but does it make sense to get an Llama server running centrally on one of the machines rather than everyone else having to set up the server? And then people can access publicly accessible.
So at the moment, the link that I showed live earlier, that is accessible from within PBD network. People in TB have tried and have failed. So I'm assuming it's only visible within PBD network.
Not quite.
Mostly,
SCD and DI would be able to get to it, but yes.
PBD network,
Yeah.
and we had others. But it's central. Manny uses it. I use it. Tim uses it. We're not running multiple links.
And we could expose it quite easily.
That's a specific model, or is it accessing lots of them?
It is currently a specific model because I don't have one. We have had issues when you load more than one model. So in principle, you can make more than one model available, but then I would need to figure out more of the mechanics of model loading and unloading automatically, which I haven't done yet because
Well,
it
I
doesn't have
think
time.
that's why Llama might be worth looking at, because it does all that, I think, in some way.
Yes, ish.
Details.
But then there's this idea of this machine in SCD. They would run it on a slightly bigger machine and not one of our repurposed GPU nets, but
So for the others who are interested, Llama and LM Studio are two things that sit on top of Llama CPP, which is the basic sort of open source repo that runs transformer type large language models. And they add features around it. They strip out some of the complexity of configuring it. They do usually run on your normal desktop machine. They're slow when you don't have a GPU. If you've got a decent bullpen driver for your integrated GPU, then you might get a bit more out than if you're just running on CPU. If you have a Mac with say, an M4 max and lots of unified memory, then you can get quite decent rates out of the Mac levels, especially.
Thanks, Jens. Nice talk. A few weeks ago, I went to the States to see what they're doing with agentic AI.
Yeah.
So Trump has pumped in a few hundred million dollars into the Genesis program, aptly named, and they want to create an AI-enabled workforce. In the States, the labs are, within the next few months, going to be preparing demonstrations, uses of agentic systems. I think we, as the facilities here, will also start to use them, mainly as co-pilots, and they have their uses, right, in documentation and things like this. But is there any push towards understanding the true cost of these systems? Like, we've heard that they're free, but they're not free.
Yeah,
right?
There's a lot of questions. So, to first order, when these things write code for you, when they're not clawed on the latest revision or something, they tend to produce code that is of the quality of a reasonably junior person making first steps at writing their own code or something. It feels a bit like it needs a senior person to throw eyes over it. So what it does replace is what I would call the typical PhD student. And that's where it becomes worrying, because you want to teach PhD students to know how to write code before you then let them use the big bugs. And if we look at funding prices that may or may not be impeding on us, and we start asking, can we afford to pay PhD students, or do we just run our local AI to do our coding for us? And that question gets answered in the wrong way, then we're killing our own future. So yes, there are intriguing questions around this.
For the facilities, I'd say that we want to be able to understand what is the cost of running some model versus the cost of employing someone to do the same, right?
Yeah.
And then what is the benefit and all of this stuff. So if we're at the early stages now and you're talking about working with SCD, I would envision some SCD hosted facility, something for the facilities.
Given that we're also as a country pumping a few hundred million or so into AI, something or other monsters.
Not sure we'll get it, but yeah.
But there must be resource somewhere to run these things slightly more efficiently than we Yes,
but I imagine in the future the question is going to be, what's the cost of running this thing? You know, how do I run a facility with an agentic system such that I'm actually saving money rather than spending more in order to achieve the same performance?
So if I think about a department like SCD, which may or may not be the department that has bought 300 Copilot licenses, then we're talking £100,000 a year for Copilot. It's going to make a lot of those people who, by and large, write software more effective at some things.
But doesn't at what cost of the environment as well, right? So if we're supposed to be measuring our CO2, are we?
Yes.
My concern is that we see this as a helpful tool, which it is, but we overuse it, and then
we could look at token generation costs per token. Well. They're usually measured in megatokens or something. So you can tell here that we've processed 270,000 input tokens so far on this running instance. I don't know when it will restart, but that's a major downside. But it's typical chat sessions that I would run are 70,000 tokens or so. So megatokens is a sort of scale that could be established for energy use or something, and then we could try and evaluate how much is that, how much would I be using in a week if I every day pump through a million tokens or something? I'm doubtful that's going to be a good outcome.
Not for sure, but I think it's...
No, as in
yeah.
We wouldn't like what it says.
No, I think exactly, right? But I think it's something that we have to keep an eye on, right?
Yes.
Maybe not for PPD, for a facility, if we're spending X amount of money, fine. But if it adds to our footprint as well, then is it really worth it?
Yes, big question.
And maybe it's
and that is the other question, is adding a person. At the moment, you couldn't add a person because you can't really hire, apart from when it's very business critical or something. So at the moment, a go-to solution for fixing quite a few problems is to turn to AI. response. It does add to our environmental footprint, and there's other costs. It is something where we can actually spend money compared to other chance. A person is anywhere between 100 and 150,000 a year.
It's still short-term thinking, but I'm talking long-term. If we roll out these systems, you know, quite heavily in facilities, which is what they want to do in places like the States, you know, are we going to have to add an extra data center just to keep our facility running? Right. So anyway, it's just a comment that maybe we should be aware of these things and think about them from the start.
I think not, but we could look at it. We could look at evaluating how much power is actually being consumed by this. I also, it depends on how high responsibility you want. Lots of these data center type applications, they're A, around training these systems, making them better, and B, about response times. So there's a lot, I don't know, Google has explicit clones of Wikipedia to be faster in querying Wikipedia, which is why Tim's name, looks at the stock names and things, takes seconds to run, but it's largely because Wikipedia query is actually slow compared to when you've got a whole lot of Wikipedia stored on your favorite cluster running 24/7 waiting for requests to come in. So I think a lot of the power footprint that we're talking about when we're talking big AI machines is this sort of super fast response time or training.
So what I'm saying there on that point is that we can balance this, right? We can define what is a good balance, and then we can define what we should be using as opposed to these massive systems that are off the shelf.
Yeah. I have asked whether there is a policy in any shape or form. People have said, sure, there's policies, but nothing that would allow me to evaluate whether I want to run something or not. And so far, the conversation just hasn't progressed to that. R3, however, it's running training courses on how to make your own AI agents. So there's a currently quite a disconnect between us and R3 in terms of what they're doing and what we're doing. I am finally talking to them on Friday, an hour. Where that goes, no idea. It seems that they're looking at this as a way to write customer interaction agents, because that's a typical application where you replace two people working in a call center with computer. So civility is just so much better.
There's a few people in facilities I can tell you that.
So it'd be nice to know if this made the round so that we can have an actual coherent conversation across SAT or even their eye about it. But at the moment, whenever you prod somebody about it, they just go, oh, I've done this, fine. So it's not really a living discussion yet.
Okay. Let's thank, I don't see any questions, so let's thank Tim and Jens again.
If you wanted to look at stuff, let us know. Presumably you're on the outside as far as TV.